the evident perfection of their constitution, to say nothing of the xenophobia that it inevitably encouraged, led most Spartans to regard the world beyond their borders with a mixture of suspicion and disdain. A series of foreign policy disasters had served only to encourage them in their insularity. The humiliation of the snub by Cyrus had been followed, in 525 BC, by an even worse debacle, when a seaborne expedition against Samos, a powerful island just off Persian-occupied Ionia, had been comprehensively repulsed. From that moment on, rather than risk further entanglements in the Aegean, most Spartans were content to turn their backs on eastern adventures. Better by far to consolidate their supremacy closer to home. Let the frontiers of the Peloponnese, then, serve the Spartans as their walls. And yet Pelops Island, despite its name, was not entirely girt in by the sea. 3 days' march north from Sparta stood the great merchant city of Corinth, and beyond it, over a narrow strip of land no wider than 6 miles, lay the cities and mountains of mainland Greece. Once the Isthmus road had passed first Athens and then Thebes, it was obliged by the peaks which hemmed in the lowlands to thread along the coastline, until, at its narrowest point, there was barely room for 2 wagons to travel side by side. The Pass of Thermopylae. To the southwest lay a region equally rich in significance, the Plain of Doris, from which the Dorians traced their name. South in turn of Doris stood a further peak, Parnassus, ravine-gashed and precipitous, and then, on the far side of that mountain, the most sacred spot in all of Greece, the Oracle at Delphi. At Delphi, the air was pure with prophecy. There, for 9 months every year, the Lord Apollo was believed to have his dwelling. More than anywhere else in the world, it was where glimpses and revelations of the future might be uncovered. That the Spartans should have had a particular admiration for Apollo was hardly surprising. Just as their ancestors had migrated to Lacedaemon, so the archer god had come to Delphi as an invader from the north. Leaving the halls of Olympus behind him, Apollo had travelled the world with his far-shooting bow, searching for an oracle that might speak to mortal men. He had found it where a monstrous python, bloated upon human prey, slumbered by a sweet-flowing icy spring. A single shot from his deadly bow had been sufficient to end the monster's reign, and from that moment on it was Apollo who had ruled as Lord of Delphi. Sprigs of laurel planted by the god served to purify the sanctuary. In time, men raised a temple there, out of boughs cut from the laurel bushes, it was said, and Apollo had uttered prophecies through the rustling of the leaves. In time, the laurel leaves themselves had fallen silent, and the god chose to speak instead through the ecstasies of a young priestess, the Pythia, in whose title could be heard an echo of Apollo's long-rotted foe. Around 750 BC, a temple of stone was raised. Shortly afterwards, it appears, it was decided that only an old woman should be appointed to serve as the Pythia, although she was still, as a symbol of purity, obliged to wear a young girl's dress. There was no other oracle to compare with it. Indeed, such was the prestige of Delphi that it became, of all the many temples founded by the Greeks, the only one to be served by a body of full-time priests. Only the Delphians, far removed in their mountain valley from all other possible forms of income, made a living from the proceeds of their shrine. Other cities, far from begrudging the priests their professionalism, were happy to collude in it. What better assurance could there be of the priests' even-handedness than that they charged everyone the same flat fee? Even those who were not Greek might approach Apollo and hope for an answer. Delphi's claims to holiness were on a truly global scale. When Croesus, for instance, faced with the growing threat of Persia, had sought divine guidance, he turned to Delphi. Not that this had saved him in the long run, of course. If Apollo's advice often appeared clear, then it was not always so. The Lord, whose oracle is at Delphi, neither speaks nor keeps silent, but offers hints. Those who misinterpreted the god would invariably come to ruin. Pondering whether to attack Cyrus or not, Croesus had consulted Delphi and received the answer that a mighty empire would fall if he did. Croesus had duly gone to war, and seen his own empire fall.